Today is February 7th. It's Tuesday morning at Akiva Academy. We're learning Parshat HaShavua. This week's Parsha is Parshat Yitro, and that's the Parsha that has within it the Ten Commandments, the great revelation at Mount Sinai. We're going to do something today a little bit different, which is that we're not going to focus on the straightforward meaning of the verses in the Parsha. We're going to focus on the Hasidic, one particular Hasidic insight into the Parsha. It's something that in the past I said we do occasionally. And the reason I chose to do it today is because in one particular Hasidic book, what's called the Mei HaShiloach, I've mentioned this in the past, the Mei HaShiloach by Rav Mordechai Yosef Liner of Izbich, in his writings on this week's Parsha, there's a passage that is simply my favorite passage in the whole book, in all of the writings of the Izbicher Rebbe, Mordechai Liner. So we're going to focus on it. I think it's powerful and important. When I started preparing this, I recognized it, and I have a feeling that I taught this particular passage to this particular group already. It might have only been 2 or 3 months ago. It might have been like brought this passage in the context of something else back in the book of Genesis. That could be. But even if it is the case, then no disaster here, no tragedy. Number one, because it's so important to hear it again. But number two, because it's not all we'll do today. It'll be a jumping off point to see something in the Ramban, Nachmanides' commentary on the Torah, and something in Rav Kook. In Rav Kook. I guess I don't have any more copies. But I have the original, and I can look in the original. Right, so we're fine. So here we are in the Mei Shiloach. We'll begin by looking at the verses in the Parsha that he begins with, that he comments on. And then we'll go to the Mei Shiloach. So this is the book of Exodus, Parshat Yitro, chapter 20. We can just look at the verses briefly inside. Chapter 20 of Exodus. It's on page, in your edition, page
441.
441, so you have the same edition. You have three of the same edition, page 441 there. And I'm going to begin reading. Page 441 in the Eitz Chaim. Is that the Eitz Chaim called?
Yes, this is
Exodus. Exodus what?
Chapter 20, verses 1, 2, and 3, and even 4. God spoke all these words, saying, I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods besides me. That's pretty recognizable. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heaven above or in the earth below or in the waters under the earth, etc. We pretty much know this. So we're going to go from there to the Mei Shiloach. And again, I hope that you'll recognize this at least a little bit. Now, the Mei Shiloach, I will just briefly remind everyone, we're talking about Poland, a town called Izbich, in the second half of the 19th century, 1860s, 70s, 80s. Rav Mordechai Liner was a colleague and student of the Rebbe Mikotsk, and he, in turn, was the rabbi and teacher of the future Rebbe of Gur, Gera Hasidut, and of Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Melublin, two very famous names in Polish Hasidut that are the students of the Mei Shiloach. So we have here a chain of tradition. I'll also mention, as I've said in the past, that there is an English translation available of the Mei Shiloach, and it's atrocious. So I brought it here for you, and you can see that on the right-hand side, I made some changes in the translation. Wherever I put in a circle an English word in the translation on the side of the page, I rewrote that word and I have an arrow to my translation. We have to look on together because I've got a copy here.
The original in Hebrew is
the original in Hebrew. It's available. Here I have a photostat of the Hebrew is in terrible Hebrew. It's probably a translation from the Yiddish.
It was written in Yiddish.
Well, it wasn't really written. It was spoken around the Shabbat table, and it was transcribed into kind of Hebrew. Okay, so the Mei Shiloach.
So the Yiddish doesn't exist at all.
I'm pretty sure the Yiddish doesn't exist. I'm certain, but certainly it doesn't exist, except in the tradition of the family, perhaps, of spoken words. So the verse says, I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And when I say the next sentence, you'll probably remember that we said this in the past. The word I in Hebrew, here in the Ten Commandments, is Anochi. Anochi. Remember I wrote on the board over there, Aleph, Nun, Chaf, Yud, Anochi. Now that word is interchangeable with another Hebrew word that also means I, and that Hebrew word is Ani, Aleph, Nun, Yud. There's Ani and there's Anochi, two interchangeable words for I. The only difference is, in meaning there's no difference, the difference is the way it's written. Ani is three letters, Anochi is four letters, and those that four-letter word is the same three letters plus one more letter. That one more letter is
Chaf.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Okay. You can take a seat at the table. Take a chair, take a seat. So, the question for the Meir Shiloach is going to be, I don't have any extra photocopies, that's for sitting at the table so you can look on with someone. The question is going to be, why did the Torah here in the first commandment, in the Ten Commandments, use the word Anochi and not use the word Ani? Okay? That's going to be the question. So we're reading in the text now. The word Ani is not used for I, but rather Anochi. That doesn't help. It's just one page, and not all the other pages.
Well, that's good enough. That's more than I have.
More than you have. Okay.
Let me read it. Okay.
Had it been written Ani, the meaning would have been that the Holy One, blessed be He, had revealed His light to Israel in all its completeness. I'm going to stop there for a second. Right, so the idea is, this is the revelation at Sinai, this is the big event, this is the most important thing that ever happened to the human race, you could say. And had it been a real full theophany, a real revelation of God's ultimate light, we would know everything, we'd have everything. Everything would be wonderful, complete, there would be shlemut, right? There would be absolute perfection, which sounds so good and so great and so enlightening. And then, says the author, and then they could not have searched deeply into his words, for he would have already revealed everything. In that sentence, the author is throwing a complete monkey wrench into our religious and psychological assumptions. Because you would think that our greatest aspiration, the most important thing we could ever hope for, is to have a complete revelation of divine wisdom and truth. But now he suddenly tells us that had there been such a thing, it would have been bad and not good. It would have created a situation in which we could not have searched deeply into his words. What that means is something very simple. If you know everything, if you have all the enlightenment, all the truth, all the insight, then there is no hope and no dream and no aspiration and no striving for more, because you have it all.
It's like watching TV.
It's like watching TV. I'll say the same thing in different language. It's being spiritually dead. Perfection is spiritual death. Ultimate truth, ultimate understanding, perfection, a case where there's no more you have to do. There's no better you can become. There's nothing to strive for. As enticing as that sounds, it's spiritual death. The assumption here of the author is that life is dynamic, and that religious life is dynamic, and that the meaning of life is that dynamism. And if you create a static religious status quo because there's no more to acquire, then you've lost the whole meaning. To put it in different language, we're putting value on process much more than we're putting value on the goal. Such that, I should say it differently, putting value on process much more than putting the value on the ultimate result, such that the goal is the process. What you want to do is be alive, to be moving. By the way, this is so, so different, just for example, than the definition of perfection in Greek philosophy. For Aristotle, perfection was, the goal was to have it all, and then to be the ultimate unchanging perfection like God. But the Mishnah says no, that ultimate unchanging perfection is spiritual death.
The goal is the quest.
It's always a quest.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how does this relate to the world to come then?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. According to this, we almost should not want the world to come. Mm-hmm. And thank God we don't have it yet. So it's a good question.
Yeah.
I'm just going to go on the table.
Not the goal is a quest. The goal itself is the quest. The quest is the goal itself.
Absolutely. I accept that. Let's read on. He didn't really explain anything yet. However, the additional letter Chaf in Anuhi teaches that it is not in a state of completion. I want to explain what he means.
Oh.
So the word Ani, Aleph Nun Yud, could have been the introduction to the Ten Commandments. God could have said, Ani, I am the God who took you out of the land of Egypt. It didn't say Ani, it said Anuhi, the extra Chaf.
Mm-hmm.
What could the extra Chaf be doing there? And we have to know, he doesn't write this, we have to know that the letter Chaf in Hebrew is sometimes an independent word that comes as a prefix to the words, and in the context of a prefix to the words to nouns, it means approximately, or almost, or about,
as if.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, he says, the fact that the Ten Commandments are introduced with the word Ani, with the addition of a Chaf in it, teaches us that God is saying, it's as if I'm your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. It's approximately, I'm approximately your God, I'm almost your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. As if to say, God is specifically and purposely limiting his revelation. Thank you. It's not really I. It's half of I. It's a quarter of I. It's about. It's approximately. It's almost. But it's not the real thing. It's not the full thing. And the Meshiloach, again, this is Hasidut. It's not the simple meaning of the text. He's giving us a deeper insight that God, in his great mercy to the Jewish people, limited the revelation and did not make it complete and absolute in order to allow us to live, to quest, to be on a search, to be on a journey, to always be moving, to be alive spiritually. God had to refrain from completely revealing himself. You might hear here shades of the Kabbalist idea of tzimtzum.
Mm-hmm.
Tzimtzum in English, of contraction. God contracts himself to leave room for human beings.
How do we say something is deeper when it's not explicitly understandable from the text? Like,
say it again, please.
Well, because last time we went over this, we the chaf only means as if it appears at the beginning of the word, not in the word.
Absolutely.
So how can we say that that's actually a deeper meaning when, I mean, it just doesn't mean that?
So, good question. In my opinion, there is absolutely no connection between what our author is saying on the one hand and the text itself. He's using the text as a hook, as a
springboard.
It's not the deeper meaning of the text in a textual sense. It's rather the deeper meaning of the text in a philosophical sense. He's explaining to us that he understands that God being God, God would not have given us all the truth, and we live in a world in which we know we don't have all the truth. Thank God we don't. And he's reading it back into the text. But it's not what the text says.
Mm-hmm. Alter says, you shall have no other gods. He says, throughout the 10 words, the commands are cast in the second person singular, and the commandments then are addressed to each and one of us.
Okay, we'll get to something very similar in another two or three sentences.
Additionally, I was just thinking that acquiring all the knowledge, doesn't that even serve you in order to serve God even better? If you have all the spiritual knowledge that you need in order to serve God, then doing everything that you know is more emphasized.
You're right.
Like medicine, you need to know all the information before you can practice it well.
But you never have it in medicine either.
Okay, but you hear the point. the point is a good point. So he is making a fundamental assumption that more than doing the right thing, more than getting it right and exact, there's a value of finding it yourself, of being involved in the process of discovery, that that process has as much, if not more, religious value than the actual fulfillment of the right. That's an important assumption, and it's not, of course, a necessary assumption. You could have thought differently.
I think that there's a suspect underlying premise in what you're saying. The idea that if God gave man everything at one time, it would destroy him. I think of a parallel of public libraries and libraries in general. All of the wisdom and knowledge of mankind has ever generated can pretty much be found in libraries. They just sit there. People don't use them. Just because you're given something doesn't mean that you necessarily are going to use it. So revealing all of that knowledge to man wouldn't necessarily crush him. It depends upon whether man embraces all of that knowledge, which we know he probably wouldn't have.
No,
so let me just comment. Indeed, it only becomes ours when we discover it ourselves. Mm-hmm. We go through the process.
Basic.
So it's all about emphasizing the process.
Exactly.
You know, when you teach children anything, mathematics or music or literature, if you teach them, this is how you add. You take these numbers and you put them together in this column and this column. You really have not taught them mathematics. You have taught them a little process. But the minute they discover what really addition means, or subtraction or division, this becomes part of them.
Yeah.
So whether you give it all to them at one time and they learn it and embrace it over a period of time, or whether you give it to them a little at a time, it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
Because they still have to embrace it completely.
And they discover it for themselves.
Yeah.
And indeed, it's about here, not being given all the light so that you can discover it for yourself. Exactly. It's about becoming actually a co-creator with God. In other words, God gives us our bodies and our minds, but then he doesn't give us the knowledge completely, but sets up a process that allows us to discover that knowledge for ourselves so that we become co-creators of ourselves together with him.
And in reference to what he just said, doesn't it you don't know the nature of the individual that you're giving it to. So just because it is good doesn't mean it will be used for good. I mean, whether that's relevant or not, don't know.
But God was omniscient and knew everything.
Okay, but it means that every person now is going to be discovering Torah on his own level, at his own pace, according to what he connects to. Let's go on and explain more.
That's what the Midrash says about Mamad HaSinai, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm, each person understands mm-hmm his level.
Right. So now he says, I'm going to read again from the fifth line. However, the additional chaf, the chaf that means approximately, in Anochi, teaches that it's not in a state of completeness. God's revelation was not complete, it was approximate. Yet rather, what was this revelation? It was a hint or a shadow. Imagined image, that's a bad translation. By the way, bad translation, it doesn't mean I disagree with the translation. The translator didn't know Hebrew. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. I've been told who he was and how he did it. He was very excited at learning Meshiloach as a beginning student in Shiva. He wrote this book without knowing the full language. Yet rather, a hint or a shadow of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, would reveal in the future. But there's much more than what was revealed to us at Mount Sinai. It will become revealed in the future.
And that's why the Messianic era is supposed to be greater than Mount Sinai. Is that what he's kind of alluding to?
I'm not sure. I don't want to get into that because it's not clear at all. That's not clear at all. The more a man apprehends in the depths of the Torah, the more he will then understand that until now he was in darkness. Everything that I know today, hopefully I will know tomorrow that it wasn't full, it wasn't complete. There were lacuna and there were certain mistakes. And of course, knowing that tomorrow I'll know more, and what I thought I knew today is actually darkness. And knowing that another 10 years I'll know more, and that what I thought I knew before that was darkness, that thought could be very depressing. It could lead me to say, all knowledge is relative, and what I know today, since I know it's not complete, I'll just throw it out the window. There's no point. But for the author, it's the opposite.
It's very exciting.
It's exciting, and it's invigorating, and it's electrifying that I have to be on a journey. And I always have more to discover, but I have to make the effort.
Doesn't it mean comprehend as opposed? Apprehend means to fear. Comprehend means to understand.
If that's the way you understand the word, then
I think that's the actual definition. Comprehend means understanding. Apprehend means fear.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. This is hinted at in the night and the day. Day means, and he's about to tell us, that the very structure of the universe in which night follows day and day follows night, that very structure is to be understood not just as a physical reality, but as a metaphor to be interpreted about the spiritual journey of life. Just like the Torah is to be understood in some cases as a metaphor for the spiritual journey of life, so the very structure of the physical universe. Day means that the blessed God opens the gates of wisdom for man, because day is about light, and light is about enlightenment. And night means that man should not imagine that he has apprehended all incompleteness.
Wow.
For all he has attained is like night in comparison to the day that follows. So I have to be very, of course, excited and invigorated by my day. Mm-hmm. But I also have to know that that day is only night compared to the day that will follow tomorrow. Day is always followed by night to remind me that every day is really night compared to the day that will come tomorrow.
That's what keeps us learning.
That's what keeps us learning. For all he has attained is like night in comparison to the day that follows. So it goes on forever. And I think it's so important for him to emphasize that it goes on forever. It's not just 10 years, and it's not just 50 years, and it's not just my lifetime. It's forever. Of course, that brings us to Adam's question, does forever include the days of the Mashiach? He doesn't talk about that, so let's not talk about that. It's a forever ongoing process.
I think in the days of the Mashiach, you have more opportunity to study, but you still don't arrive. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fun.
Good point. Well, and it follows that all is night in the face of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, will open in the future. So, there is here a tremendous statement about process, about the journey, about movement, about discovery. And he's certainly talking on the level of the individual. Mm-hmm. Our spiritual lives, if we base them completely on habit and tradition, then we're dead. And we're actually distorting the Torah. Because what we have today, what we understand today, is not meant to be the be-all and end-all. Everyone has to strive to learn more, to do more, to understand more and differently. And if you don't do so, you are simply treading water. And you're, again, distorting the Torah. There's always more to learn. There's always more depth to understand. There's always more spirituality to search for on an individual level. But it's also true on a communal level. That the way our synagogues function, the way we understand Torah in our generation, the way our institutions are set up, and the way our leaders, our Gedolei Torah, understand Torah, that also is in a state of flux, and it must be in a state of flux. Of course, it's a state of flux that's not anarchy. It's always based on incrementally new insights, but still there's always going to be development, and there's always going to be change. And if there's not, then something is missing. Let me just give an example. We spoke 3 or 4 weeks ago about the daughter of Paro. And at least from my perspective, I learned things that I'd never seen before. And I learned things that certainly weren't explicit in the commentators of 100 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago. How did we discover those new things? Should we be contrite, and should we be upset that we said things that the earlier commentators didn't say, so we must be wrong? The opposite is the case. Every generation is supposed to be searching for new insights, new uncover new discoveries in Torah that were always there, but were never seen, as it were, because every generation is on its journey. I just want to tell the story that I've told in the past. Rashi, the most famous, illustrious Bible commentator in France in the 11th century. Every young student of Torah learns Rashi's commentary on the Chumash, on the five books of Moses. Rashi had a number of daughters and no sons, and his daughters were married and they had children. Rashi's grandchildren, two of them became very, very, very famous rabbis. One of them was Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, and he wrote a commentary himself on the Torah, just like Rashi wrote a commentary, so did he also. And he tells the following story, the Rashbam does, in his commentary in the book of Genesis. He said, once I went to my grandfather, and I showed him my commentary on this particular verse, and I said to him, you know, grandfather, with all due respect, I think that I just wrote something here that you're wrong about. You didn't write properly. And Rashi says, you're right. Says to his grandson, you're right. And had I had the time, I would write a new commentary that reflects Hapshatim Hamitchadshim B'chol Yom, the interpretations that are born anew every day. The fact that the Rashbam wrote something that his grandfather didn't write, that's not bad, that's good. It's good to search for new interpretations. Not because I want to force into the text what I think, but because I really know that the text has so much more to say that has not yet been discovered, and until those new things are discovered, something's missing. And every generation adds to the, in an incremental fashion, adds to the body of tradition.
So are we adding to the Peshat or to the Midrash, or what are the new insights coming from?
Everywhere.
Well, even the division is artificial.
Yeah, like what we said about the daughter of Paro 3 weeks ago, I think that's Peshat, or almost Peshat.
So if the opposite of being in a state of flux is stagnation. If you
right.
sit there and don't make any new discoveries
right.
by studying and have no new insight, you're not really in a state of perfection. You're in a state of stagnation.
Absolutely.
Well said. Well said. Right. Don't stagnate. Spirituality has to be a constant search for newness.
Well, on the other hand, if we continue, Rambam is our, and Rabbi Akiva are our main study. People we study, how can we say there's been, unless we study Rabbi Cook, there's been nothing changed in the last 1,000 years.
What do you mean, unless we study?
Well, if all we rely upon is the commentators of 1,000 years ago, that means we haven't learned anything in the last 1,000 years, doesn't it?
Well, you're basically right. Right, our study should not be just parroting what earlier commentators
yes.
said. We have to find
new
things.
But the reason should be in all areas of our lives.
Mm-hmm. But, that's probably true.
But don't we study them in one sense because they teach us a thinking process to approach? If a modern person were to read the Torah, they're not necessarily giving a better interpretation if they're doing it haphazardly.
Absolutely. Right. To find new things in the Torah doesn't mean to hold the book upside down. Oh, some new interpretation there. It's modern art. Right. Obviously, there has to be knowledge of the language.
Did it before.
Say it again?
The Yemenites did it before.
There has to be knowledge of the language. There has to be a deep understanding of context. There has to be knowledge of what past commentators have said. There has to be the incremental additions to tradition, and not just someone who doesn't know what he's talking about. And there has to be a serious sincerity that what I'm trying to do, as I said earlier, is not to read into the text what I want to see there, but rather to find what the text has to tell me. It has to be a sincere effort to interpret.
You know, someone, unfortunately I don't remember who, in the Middle Ages, among the early texts of Kabbalah, said that the place of our feet is on the shoulders of our forefathers.
Right, uh-huh. Right.
So we need the forefathers to put our feet somewhere.
Right. We can see more than them, not because we're greater than them, simply because we're on their shoulders. Absolutely.
Who said it?
It's very well known. I can't tell you where it's written.
I know that it was in the comic book, Pogo. You know?
So I want to add now another element into this, which is humility. I think that this teaches us a large dose of humility, because he tells us that what I know today is not the full truth. As wise as I think I am, and as insightful as anyone might think they are, no one has the full truth. Not compared to others, and not compared to what you'll know tomorrow. And therefore you have to be humble about what you think you know. Of course, you have to have great loyalty and dedication to the Torah as you know it. But at the same time, humility, because there's much more than you know today. And if you look back at what you thought yesterday and the day before and the year before and the month before, that of course should add to our humility, seeing how far we've gone. And we'll hopefully go the same distance in the future. Okay, next paragraph. The next paragraph is based on the next few words in the Torah. So in the Torah we read in chapter 20, verse...
I just want to ask a question. Are there others who have written in the same way about the addition of the kaf?
I don't know. This particular insight based on that letter could be original to the Me'a Shiloach. But the ideas are developed by his students, certainly. By his son, by his students. So in the Torah it says, I'm Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. We saw that already. And then it says, you shall not make for yourself a sculptured image, a carved image, or any likeness which in the heavens above and the earth below, etc. So now we're going to read, according to our author, the connection between the first commandment, I'm Lord your God, and the second commandment, do not make any sculptured image. He's going to make a connection between these two. And it's a bit complicated what he says. Linguistically, so I have to explain. When it says in the Torah, do not make for yourself a sculptured image, the word for sculptured image is pesel. The Hebrew word pesel means a statue, an idol, an image, something that's carved out. Okay? Now, that word pesel, pei samech lamed, is here a noun. Don't make for yourself a pesel. But that word can also be, the root can also be used as a verb. Psol means to carve. Pesel is carved, something carved. Psol means to carve. Now just listen to this. Remember that there are really two revelations at Sinai. The first commandment, the first tablets, and the second tablets. Moses hears the Ten Commandments together with all of the Jewish people in our chapter right in front of us now, chapter 20. And then he goes up to the mountain and gets the tablets that have the Ten Commandments that we just heard written on them. But when he's about to come down, God notices, and Moses notices, that the people have made the golden calf. They've revolted. They've done terrible things. And Moses smashes the tablets. And God wants to abrogate the breach, the covenant. And then the people repent, and there's a process of reconciliation between God and the people. God relents and says, okay, I'll give you a second chance. And says to Moses, come up to the mountain for a second giving of the tablets. But in the second giving of the tablets, this is chapter 33 and chapter 34 of Exodus, this time it's not that God gives Moses tablets that have recorded on them the Ten Commandments. Rather, God says to Moses, make tablets for yourself and bring them up to me, and we'll write on the tablets together. It's not that God presents the tablets. Moses has to make the tablets. And you know what the word is that God uses when he says, Moses, make for yourself tablets, carve tablets? The word is psol. Carve for yourself tablets. Psol lecha. Make for yourself, carve for yourself. So the Me'a Shiloach is going to be basing himself on a statement in the Zohar that makes a connection between what it says in our chapter today, don't make for yourself a carved image, a connection between that and what it says later in chapter 34 of Exodus in the second tablets when God says to Moses, so, carve. So there's a contradiction. Not a real contradiction. I mean, not in the Pshat, it's not a contradiction. But the Zohar sees here a contradiction. On the one hand, God says, don't make any carving. But then later, God says to Moses, carve. Okay?
Don't carve images.
There's a big difference.
Of course there's a big difference, but that doesn't matter. This is mystical interpretation.
It's the jumping off point.
So, right, it's just the jumping off point. So, he now quotes from the Zohar. This is why the verse that follows immediately is, do not make any carved image. On which it is said in the Holy Zohar, since it was first written, it shouldn't say it first written, since it was later written, carve for yourself. Therefore it says, do not make any carved image. Meaning, do not make another Torah. So the interpretation seems to be like this. God says to Moses, carve for yourself. That's the Torah. Carve for yourself. Then we have this commandment, do not make any carved images. The Zohar says it, what it means is, don't make anything beyond another Torah. One Torah I already made for you. Psol lecha. Carve for yourself. Don't make any others. That's the way the Zohar understands it. The Me'a Shiloach learns from the Zohar that we should highlight this juxtaposition of the two words carving, but the Me'a Shiloach understands it differently, understands the juxtaposition differently. The Me'a Shiloach is about to say the following. I'll say it first and we'll read it. Psol lecha, carve for yourself. That's the Torah. Let me just think the thought. When it says, don't make for yourself a carved image, it's going to mean, don't make the Torah into an idol. Don't make the Torah into an idol. Since when Moses was told by God to make the Torah, as it were, by carving an image, that opens up a Pandora's box. You might think the Torah is meant to be a carved image, an idol. Therefore it says, don't make for yourself any carved images. It means, on the Hasidic level, don't turn the Torah into an idol. Now, we don't know yet what that means. Don't turn the Torah into an idol. Now, we have to explain. What does it mean, don't turn the Torah into an idol? So here he goes. The word pesel, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement, right? It's carved out in a state of completeness. All its measurements are made with nothing lacking. I'm going to stop there. In other words, never, ever, ever think or believe or act as if the Torah, as you understand it today,
is closed.
Never think it's closed and complete and exact and perfect. If you think that the Torah that you know today is closed and complete and exact and perfect, you have turned the Torah into a carved image. Mm-hmm. Carved images are clear and exact. They have features. You make a sculpture of a giraffe, and here's the neck, and here's the neck, and here's the neck, and here's the neck, and here's the body and the legs. You can see exactly what it is. And you know that that's a giraffe. The Torah should never be like that giraffe. The Torah always, you should understand, has a degree of fluidity. A degree that you know what you know today. You won't know tomorrow, because tomorrow you'll know better.
Did he not have high opposition? He was quite visionary and quite rebellious.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Did he have any opposition?
Of course, before? Of course.
They always have opposition to each other.
Of course. So let's think. Now, this is not the most radical statement that Ilana is making into. He's just telling us to have great, great humility with the Torah as I understand it today.
Yes. It ties with the other.
But that doesn't happen a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've been told, I'm going to show you what the Torah really means. I've been told that several times, you know. So that's, I would imagine that's kind of what he's talking about.
Of course.
Be careful with that, right? Be careful with people claiming they have all the truth in their back pocket. He says we never have the truth in back pocket. Of course, the truth we do have, we have to be loyal to, we have to love, we have to be committed to, we have to be willing to give our lives for the Torah as we know it. It's the only Torah we have. But at the same time, you have to know, tomorrow, your Torah hopefully will be a little bit better. And a little bit better every single day. It always gets better. And you have to strive to make it better. And the minute you think that your Torah, as you understand it today, is all and everything, you'll stop striving. Mm. And that's spiritual death.
Question. Referring to the word vessel, surely it has to be a little bit metaphorical. Well, not a little bit, it has to be metaphorical.
It's all metaphorical.
Okay, because a graven image can be a drawing.
Fine.
Okay.
It's all metaphorical. So now, we're going to read the sentence that we just read, and we're going to complete the sentence because he says something at the end that seems to contradict everything we've said. The word pesel, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement, in a state of completeness, with nothing lacking. And this exists only in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. He seems to contradict everything.
That's the one that broke.
Good. Because it seems to be a contradiction, because I've said the Torah we have is not complete, it is not perfect, and suddenly he says that completion only exists, that perfection only exists in the Torah. What he means is that in a certain sense, there are two Torot. There is the perfect Torah, God's Torah, that he gave to Moshe, but that Torah never reached us. Because each of us got the Torah through the prism of our own mind, of our own culture, of where we are. God, as it were, you can say, has the whole Torah, but by the very nature of the human mind, that our mind is human and not divine, we never grasp the whole thing, we grasp pieces of it. So at Mount Sinai, every Jew got a piece of the Torah. And the fact that he got only a piece and not the whole thing is Baruch Hashem, thank God. And we got the whole thing.
That's why we need each other.
We need each other. And we need the journey again. Yes. So there is such a thing as the holy, pristine, absolute, divine, complete Torah. And the individual pieces that each of us have, individually and communally, is part of a journey towards getting more and more, discovering more and more, uncovering more and more of God's Torah. Now again, I have to say, the little piece we have is a lot. It's the best thing in the world. There could be nothing better than having a piece of the divine Torah. It's nothing, God forbid, to belittle, to make light of. It's only half, it's only incomplete. No, it's a constant quest towards growing it. However, for the mortal intellect to fashion something in complete perfection like this is impossible. Right? It's just a slow process. Okay, so we will read on. On this it is written, that he brings a midrash from Ruth Rabbah. Caesar said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina, Caesar is a name for the local Roman ruler, I too can make a Torah like Moshe. I can make a law that will be just as wonderful and absolute light as God's law. And he decreed that no fire be kindled for 3 days. God said, for 1 day on Shabbat, I'll tell 3 days, my law can be better than God's. During this time, he saw smoke rising from a house. And Caesar explained to him, meaning to the rabbi, that a certain government minister was sick and was necessary to permit him fire. So Caesar had to bend his law because one of the ministers had to make a fire. That's the end of the Midrash. Says the Meir Shiloh, for indeed, according to our holy Torah, the law is that saving a life supersedes laws of Shabbat. We also have exceptions, like Caesar made an exception for people who are sick. Yet the difference with us in the example of Caesar is that one who violates Shabbat to save a life is not going against the holy Torah. But thus it was also commanded that saving a life takes precedence over the laws of Shabbat. It's part of the Torah. In other words, when the rabbis in the Talmud, quote unquote, promulgated the law that you are allowed to violate Shabbat to save human life, what they were doing was discovering within the Torah a deeper level that they hadn't seen before. That's what this connects to what we're talking about.
Oh.
Then he goes on to say, we'll read another sentence,
so too... This is rabbinic. In the Torah there is no hint for that?
The Torah never says explicitly that you... Never says explicitly. Never says explicitly. So too in all places where it is a time to do for God, in that very place is also hinted that we should void your law. That's a rabbinic interpretation. That means that the rabbis have the authority and the responsibility to make changes and abrogations in the law in order to facilitate the greater keeping of the law, depending on changing circumstances.
So who gave the rabbis that?
I was asked on Sunday, right? let's not go back there. And the point is the same again, that the rabbis have the authority and the responsibility to discover in the Torah new interpretations, and we use the word discover, as if to say they're always there, but we didn't yet find them. We didn't get that far on our journey. The journey has to continue. Therefore, the Torah includes all the possible combinations of events that may occur. A better translation is the Torah includes all the possible combinations of interpretations that may occur. And its light surrounds all the possibilities and all the experiences that may evolve, and it's not in the power of any man to do this. But rather, we discover, and it's not in the power of any man to create such a law that has all these possibilities latent within it that have to be discovered. This is the explanation of the Holy Zohar on do not make any coward form, right? That's the second commandment. Meaning positive commandments, any image the prohibitive commandments, the negatives, for nothing is revealed in its absolute fullness. Meaning that the Zohar says, very similar to what the Me'ashi Luach just said, when it says don't make a carved image, that means don't turn the positive and negative commandments into idols. Know that the way we have them today is the way we have to follow them, but you should never think that it's always going to be the same. Don't make it into an idol. It may change as we discover deeper meanings within the Torah.
It's a lot harder because you never feel that you're at a resting point.
Right, there's always more to do and to learn and to discover. So we're talking about journey, we're talking about process, we're talking about humility, we're talking about understanding that God's truth is far, far, far beyond any part of it that we can latch onto at any given generation for any given person. So now, what I want to do, in the short amount of time that's remaining, is I want to show how Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk took these ideas and developed them. Rav Kuk, as far as I know, never explicitly mentioned the Me'ah Shiloach that we're learning, but Rav Kuk is the next generation after. Rav Kuk is certainly a Kabbalist and a Hasid. He knows Hasidut, respects Hasidut, loves Hasidut. And it looks to me, from tens of different affinities I've found between Rav Kook and the Me'ah Shiloach, that Rav Kook was influenced by the Me'ah Shiloach, or at least from the students of the Me'ah Shiloach. But he also develops it and changes it.
So he didn't study with him directly?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And in order to understand Rav Kook, we first have to look at a passage from the Ramban, Nachmanides, in his commentary on the Torah. And since time is very late, I'll just tell you that it's here on the sheet, but we're not going to read it. I'll tell you outside what the Ramban says. The Ramban was a Kabbalist in Spain in the 13th century, the 1200s. And in his commentary to the Torah, his non-Kabbalistic commentary, which has some Kabbalistic insights, there are two important points for our purposes that we want to talk about. One is that he brings the Kabbalistic metaphor that the Torah is written with letters of black fire upon a background of white fire. Ah, I never saw that. Because he's not referring to the Torah that we got. He's referring to God's Torah. God's Torah is written with letters of black fire upon a background of white fire. Second point, he says that the Torah, as we know it today, has a certain number of letters in a certain order. And those letters are divided into words in a certain fashion. Says the Ramban, based on Kabbalistic wisdom, that God's Torah is those same letters in the same order, but divide into words differently. Hear that? String of letters. And in God's Torah, the same order. There's actually an argument among the Kabbalists if it's the same order or different order. But the Ramban says it's the same order. In God's Torah, the same letters in the same order, broken differently into words. What does that Torah say, God's Torah? It's a string of names of God. From beginning to end, it's just a string of names of God. And of course, to say a string of names of God is a metaphor that explains that it's the ultimate truth. It's just God. God, 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 God. It's all God. But those same letters in the same order, broken differently into words, tell us stories and give us commandments. So what we're saying here is the same thing the Meshiloach said in different language. We're saying that there's an ultimate pristine Torah, and then there's the way that we have it. The way we have it is a reflection, a refraction of the real thing, and it's great and it's wonderful and it's the best that can be in any given generation, but it's not the ultimate. We always have to go to our Torah and trace it back to the original pristine Torah. We have to discover more divine names, more divinity, more truth in the Torah that we have. So I'm just showing you how what the Meshiloach says connects to a similar idea couched in Kabbalistic language.
A little echo of Plato as well here.
Very good, very good. Not necessarily because they learned Plato, because it's a universal idea.
Yeah.
So now with that background, we can understand something in Rav Kook. We're in the middle of beginning of the 20th century. Rav Kook is the first chief rabbi of the reconstituted Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. He has to deal with, of course, a generation that is being secularized at a rampant pace. If you think our generation is secular, our generation is stably secular. His generation was becoming secular. He saw before his eyes in Europe and then in the land of Israel, thousands upon thousands leaving Torah, leaving observance, leaving synagogues and closing the door behind them. At the same time that Rav Kook saw blatant secularism and assimilation, blatant secularism and leaving behind of the Torah, he saw secular Jews who were deeply devoted to the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. He saw Zionism. He saw the pioneers. He saw the building of the land of Israel through people who were turning their backs on Torah. And of course, he developed a whole philosophy to understand what was going on. And we're reading what he wrote in this essay called The Pangs of Cleansing. The translation is found in this book. A wonderful, wonderful, wonderful translation of some of Rav Kook's writings. Religion is corrupted by the decline of the higher Torah, through which one gains the recognition of the greatness of God, the higher perfection that is infinite and beyond assessment. The higher Torah is what was called by the Ramban the black fire on white fire. That's the real, true, divine Torah. It's the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu in the language of the Mea Shiloach. It's the ultimate divine truth. And religion, as Rav Kook will say, is always supposed to be make an effort to conform to the ultimate Torah. It's never exactly the same thing, but it's always to be growing and perfecting itself. Rav Kook says, in my generation, religion is corrupted by the decline of the higher Torah. And he means to say that the Torah as we know it and practice it is not making an effort to imitate the true Torah. There is some corruption in our generation. And he mourns that. Thus our religion does not yield the noble fruit it ought to yield. It does not raise the souls from their lowly state, and the numbers of those who dishonor it and desecrate it increase. Rav Kook here blames not the secularists, but he blames the Torah itself. When I say that, I mean the Torah as understood by the generation. He blames the way the generation understands Torah for the fact that droves and droves of young people are leaving it. It's not only their fault, it's our fault, says Rav Kook. However, the Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite, in God, which transcends every particular content of religion. And what he means to say is that the true Judaism is that black fire and white fire. And that transcends the way we understand Judaism in any particular generation. Again, it's the Meshiloach. It's the same thing in different language. We always have to understand that as dedicated as we must be to the Torah as we know it, the Torah as we know it is not
the ultimate.
The ultimate. There's something beyond that. We always have to be striving to make our Torah more and more in accord with the real Torah. So again, I'll read that again. However, the Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite, which transcends every particular content of religion. And for this reason, the Jewish religion may truly be considered as the ideal religion, the religion of the future. What he means to say is, the reason Judaism can be considered the ideal religion is because Judaism knows that the particular expression of Judaism, called Judaism every generation, is not what it's really striving to be. Because Judaism knows that it's always striving to be more than it is, that's what makes it the ideal. What makes it the ideal? The journey, the process, the aspiration, and the humility that what we have now is not what we really believe in. It's a shadow. It's a great shadow. It's the most perfect shadow, but it's only a shadow. We're devoted to it, and we're loyal to it, but part of that loyalty is being humbly involved in making conform to a greater and greater degree to the real Torah that, as it were, is in black fire on white fire in heaven. It's the humility of the journey that makes Judaism the ideal religion, the religion of the future, that I shall be what I shall be. Right? God describes himself with the burning bush as Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh, I shall be what I shall be. And whatever that means in context from Rav Kook, it means process. I shall be. Always developing. Which is immeasurably higher than the content of religion in the present. Right? The aspiration, the truth, the ultimate, is always beyond how we understand it in the present. The ideal essence descends many levels to become the Jewish religion as a corporate religious establishment rather than the ideal essence of religion. However, I understand Judaism privately, and however Judaism expresses itself in the present, that's good and that's great, but it's not the ultimate divine ideal. And I'll just add parenthetically, to me this is very important, this is about humility, not only on the individual level, but I apply it to the denominational level. In our life today, in Dallas and in America and the world, the three major Jewish denominations, as far as I can see, are full of arrogance. Each one thinks it has the full and only truth. How many times have I heard Orthodox Jews completely and absolutely just make fun of Reform Judaism? And how many times I've heard the opposite? How many times have Reformed Jews say that Orthodox Judaism is just a primitive throwback, it's a fossil? Well, they're both right.
I have heard more than that.
And they're both wrong.
I heard from extreme Orthodox Jews in Dallas that before they were in Dallas, and they're all of 30-something years old, there were no Jews in Dallas.
God forbid to say that. Right, my mentor and my teacher, Rav Yitz Greenberg, always likes to say it's okay to be an Orthodox Jew as long as you're ashamed of it. It's okay to be a Reformed Jew as long as you're ashamed of it. In other words, our denominations, they fossilize a certain understanding as if that's the only understanding. So you have to take a position because you can't be nowhere. Rabbi Yitzchak Greenberg.
Ah, oh, of course, right. It suits him.
Say it again, please.
It suits him to say that.
Right. So this is not an easy way to live, because if we have to make sure that we maintain our absolute loyalty and love and commitment to Judaism, because it's all we have and it's the best we can have, but it's not the best it could be. And there always has to be humility for what we have and hope to develop more in the future and to bring Judaism further on its journey. And that happens on the individual level primarily, that we learn more and we grow more spiritually, intellectually, and we come closer and closer to God and our worship of God, and our Avodat Hashem, and we bring our institutions further along the journey, and we develop Torah leaders and Torah scholars who have a greater and greater insight into the true divine Torah, and hopefully we're building the palace of Torah together, and we're coming closer and closer to the ideal divine essence of religion.
And hopefully we include all of us.
Amen.
As opposed to the other areas. And there are the other false messiahs of communism and socialism and Buddhism in Eastern Europe, which the Jews were very prominent in.
But it's not
But they're willing to try.